We're here today with Dr. Helmut Panke from BMW. You're on the board of directors at Microsoft. Tell us a little bit about your career and how you came to be chairman and CEO of BMW.
I started out as a physicist, focusing first on atomic physics and then on really basic nuclear physics. I did get my degrees, the master's correspondent in Germany, plus my doctorate in atomic physics. And afterwards, I was really working as the famous white-frocked scientist in a big laboratory, Swiss Institute for Nuclear Physics, doing basic research. Nothing with nuclear technology and nuclear power plants, but really what makes the world go around inside a nucleus in there. And that was the result of an interesting, very interesting high school experience that I had as an exchange student in the US. I went to Phillips Exeter Academy in New Hampshire as an exchange student and had the greatest lab course you can imagine. And out of that, before graduating, I asked myself the question, gee, what is it that I want to major in college and university? And I was torn between physics, because of that exciting experience, and business. And I decided to give in to what my tummy told me, yeah, do what you love. I went into physics. I did that for a number of years, doing after the educational part and academic part in the basic research experience, and then could do the second part, moving into business. So getting what was half of my personality interest set being fulfilled by becoming a consultant with McKinsey and Company.
So it does seem like a difficult transition.
Not at all. I mean, in the moment, yes, you are kind of torn between, do I give in to what my heart tells me, or do I give in to what my brain tells me? But when you follow what your heart and your tummy tells you, you're usually right. And this is also what I, or we, my wife and I, try to teach our children there. So talking about McKinsey, I attended a conference on research management and physics, where McKinsey was also presenting and talking about new concept, how to organize, how to structure, how to set priorities in research. And out of that, we started talking about what kind of people work within McKinsey. And the answer was, well, it depends on the individual. There's no clear-cut set of rules in there. So we started talking, and I ended up getting a job offer for McKinsey management consultants, first out of Düsseldorf in Germany, and then moving to Munich. And I worked with McKinsey for 4 years, basically getting my on-the-job training for the business part of Helmut here, and at the same point in time, really applying the scientific analytic strengths that I think I have in more business-oriented situations, setting priority programs for research projects within bigger organizations, how to organize R&D, how to couple R&D activities with market needs in there. And out of that, really got this, let's say, combination of scientific approaches and management approaches. And that helped me to accept a job offer from BMW.
So do you feel that your scientific research background helps you today as a business leader?
The scientific background will always help me. At the same point in time, also, it will be a feature that some people will say, oh, he is much too analytical. But the analytic approaches basically give me a certain advantage, in my view, in analyzing maybe faster than others what are the next levels of consequences in there. Mm-hmm. But I would say that I'm at the same point in time a rather emotional person. So combining analytics with emotions, I think, is what describes the person in here. And that, in the end, is one of the key features also of what an emotional product like a BMW really should have. High technology, scientific approaches in whatever is in the car, plus the emotional appeal to give the driver and the unique, ultimate driving experience. So in the end, my third career was with BMW, 25 years basically. But when you split that up, it was 8 different senior executive positions I did have within BMW. I worked in every division, from planning, R&D, to manufacturing, to sales and marketing, HR, IT, And in the end, ending up not just as the CEO of the US and North American operation, but becoming the CEO of the BMW group worldwide. Mm-hmm. But I think this is all, in hindsight, potentially a consequence of having had those various experiences in my previous life. And now in my, let's say, fourth step of my career, using all the experience and what is deeply ingrained in my brain and my inner part in my board mandates, whether it's at Microsoft or at Singapore Airlines, Bayer, and UBS.
What is it like to be a board member at Microsoft?
What is it like to be a board member? It's fascinating because there are so different personalities within the board. And everybody, I think, that will see our interview and hear our interview knows Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer. But let's take the independent directors on the board. It's a wide array from somebody who is very consumer electronics entertainment oriented, like Reed Hastings, to somebody like Dave Marquardt, who has been on the board basically since the beginning and who is a, let's say, startup capital oriented thinker with a vast experience in there, to Maria Clave, the, let's say, academic and teacher, brings in the feedback from the new generation in there, to Dina Dublon and Chuck Noski with their financial background. But I also had the experience with old hands, if I may say that, as politically incorrect as it sounds, like John Shirley and Gary Reed, who have been with the Microsoft in the beginning. They left a couple of years after I had joined. So the different personalities with the different approaches to tackling questions, how we discuss one topic with, in our current situation, 9 board members bringing in their perspective, that's fascinating. So it's this vast array of personality that makes the discussions so interesting, but we all come together with the different influences, with the different experiences, with the different ways to think and express our feelings in there. So that is the exciting part of it. But with having said that, with all of that, there are basic needs. What has to be done in a board meeting? Yes, we have to do all the governance-oriented stuff from whether it's audit committee or whether it is antitrust compliance activities or whether it is on the finance side or company. But the interesting part of the board work is the strategic oversight part. So talking with the senior executives, the senior leadership team of what is the next basically step, what is the direction that Microsoft should take, and that combined with the creativity of the independence plus the experience of Bill and Steve, and that makes the discussion so fascinating. But in the end, it is so understated when you just read somewhere in the governance papers, it is a key role to basically make sure that long-term shareholder interests are observed by the leadership. That's paper. In the end, how is that done? It's discussing strategies. And that is shown, for example, in the regular schedule of the meetings there, where at each of the meetings, one of the business groups presents where we are, what we will do, what are our strategic plans, and then in a strategic seminar that happens once a year, we bring together the different strategic inputs from the business groups, from the technologies, from research into, let's say, a scenario, a picture of where should Microsoft move. So it's much more active, much more lively than making sure that the shareholder interests are observed and strategic oversight. That's fascinating.
And what is, for those who might not know, what is the primary role of the board? Is it direction or is it more looking at the overall business?
It is the oversight. So in that sense, it is reviewing and discussing and giving input. But that, in a certain sense, can only be done with an active role in the strategic process in there. So you cannot just have one answer, but it's a combination of oversight, governance, plus active counseling role in strategic decisions. So the board itself does not formulate a strategy. This is done by the organization, by the leadership, but the direction or the proposals for direction are discussed with the board, are reviewed, are receiving input, and thus outside or independent or additional perspective is brought in order to make sure what is so simply put in all the governance paper, make sure that the long-term interests of the shareholders are observed in there. So it is a very vibrant and active process in there.
How does one prepare for a Microsoft board meeting?
Lots of material, but with new technology now, there is a secure server where all the documents, all the proposals, all the reports, all the minutes of the meetings are put on, and you could read that. I can do that in Munich. I can do that when I'm traveling by logging onto that secure server and read the material. So it is usually put up there about 10 days before the next meeting. So we really have lots of documents. If you really see that then in paper, it's a pile of paper that usually is something like 5 inches thick. So you can say then part is the governance-oriented part with the minutes of the meetings and plus some of the board resolutions when new officers have to be appointed. That's the minor part in there. But the real documents from the business groups, from research, from basically all the technology people in there preparing for the agenda of the next meeting is the major part of it. And we haven't addressed that question yet. We have four regularly scheduled meetings, physical meetings, which usually happen here in Redmond. And then on top of that, whether it's necessary because of some additional strategic activities or because of some, other external influence, we have extra meetings. And on top of those regularly scheduled meetings, we have about one telephonic or web-based conference per quarter. So in the end, if you look at the schedule, it's some like eight meetings per year out of which half usually is a physical meeting here in Redmond, and the others are modern web-based and audio-based conferences.
So I'm sure people are very interested in what actually goes on in a board meeting. What are the things that you like best about the meetings?
This is a question where that's a smile on my face right now. I would say the best part is what is happening outside the meeting.
Yeah.
So a board meeting usually consists of 2 days. And the first day is committee meetings, plus then in the early evening and evening, an informal get-together of the board. And before dinner, it is usually a discussion with, let's say, the next generation or generations of people within the Microsoft organization, so that the board members also get to know what makes Microsoft be Microsoft also for the future. Understand basically what are the views, the interests, the strengths, the, let's say, interesting ideas coming out of a group of usually 10, 8 younger, but high potential people out of the organization, different fields in there. Discuss with them over a glass of Coke or a glass of wine and some finger food there for about an hour. And then we have the informal board dinner where we just sit around the table. Yes, everybody has to eat, but discussing basically what is coming up, what is going to happen the next day in the full board meeting. So go back to where I started. First day committees plus this informal part, and then the second day the full board meeting. So in the end, the what I call the most interesting part is happening outside the meetings, because you discuss with your fellow board members some of the points that will be discussed the next day or were discussed in the meetings in there. But when you analyze the agenda, whether it's for committees or for the full board meeting, I would say 60% really is focusing on new issues, directional issues, what I try to express as the strategic discussion in there. And then the 40% is governance and process in there. And the interesting part really is the strategic discussion. Sometimes it's really great to have product presentations, whether you talk about ideas for a next generation of client devices, or whether you see what next generation of servers could do or will do in there with some visualization and hands-on product. Yeah. That's the interesting part. But as a human being, I still say, yeah, basically what is happening also outside the agenda is a very interesting part of it.
Leading a global company, how does that inform the work that you do with Microsoft?
When you just look at this positioning of a company, and you use BMW, but we could also take the Microsoft position there, there's always a promise to the end user, a promise to the consumer out there, what a brand stands for. And everybody in an organization, we should not forget, and it's a, I would almost say, funny coincidence, BMW has about 100,000 associates. Microsoft is just below 100,000, 92 or 91,000 right now. We're about same size organizations. And everybody in the respective organization has to understand what the promise is. And this promise has to be delivered, has to be fulfilled with every product, with every service, with every contact that you have with an end user anywhere in the world. Once you break that promise and you don't deliver, this is when a tiny bit of the positioning breaks away. It's a different promise for each company. So BMW's promise of the ultimate driving machine is something which has to be fulfilled in all the aspects that I mentioned. But also on the other hand, Microsoft's promise, Microsoft's vision and promise of enabling the consumer, whether it's an individual or a business, to fully make use and benefit from its potential. Yeah? That's something which we have to, in whatever form and shape, continuously deliver. And that's something where really the experience comes together. Once you say, this is not necessary. Let's have a little bit of compromise in here. Bring a product, accept a service proposal that is not up to that promise, that's where we have a problem. This is why in a certain set of products, Microsoft has to be aware that we should not offer it because it wouldn't fit. This is always the discussion out in the market. Why doesn't Microsoft have XYZ? That little startup has a fascinating thing. If it doesn't fit our promise of having this borderless experience, at the same point, limitless, seamless experience across all our products, we shouldn't do it. If we begin to break up the consumer experience, the end user experience, it's a tough situation. And one of the senior executives used the term in the discussion yesterday, consumer is king. End user is king. We have to think in terms of what can we do to help the end user and think in terms of the end user experience. As fascinating as some of the technologies are, if it doesn't fulfill our promise, our vision towards the consumer, then we shouldn't do it.
You're on some other boards, the board of Singapore Airlines, UBS, and Bear, four very different companies. What can you draw from each that helps each other?
Maybe the best, but at the same time also the most concise answer is knowing what you stand for. In some discussion I once said, a brand is a promise. Microsoft is a brand. Yes, it's a big organization, lots of products, many people in there. But in the end, Microsoft, the word Microsoft, the logo Microsoft, is a promise that is fulfilled with all the products and services out there. And Singapore Airlines, in its very different business, delivering premium experience in long-haul travel, is a promise. Singapore Airlines has to strive and is striving to always be at the top of travelers' satisfaction, travelers' happiness, travelers getting more than what they expect in that segment of travel. Singapore Airlines cannot compete with discount travel. It shouldn't, because it's a different position in there. Take Bayer, the German pharmaceutical, concentrates on certain parts of the market. But in those markets, it is either number one or number two. Bayer is not moving into discount generica in the pharmaceuticals. It is very focused. And in that sense, an organization has to know what it stands for with everything that it does. and the four companies where I'm on the board in what I called before my fourth stage in professional career, all have a premium positioning in their various or respective business segments in there. And there's one more interesting lesson. When you just look at Bayer, the pharmaceutical, it is quietly, without headlines, changing its organizational structure, its business portfolio, let's say every 5-6 years, with the strategic shifts in what the markets need, what strengths the company is building in its research labs in that period. So it's not a static company like the good old smoke stack oriented industries that we have seen in the US and Europe. We build it, we have it for the next 100 years, but really think in terms of continuously reinventing yourself. And that's an approach that also has to be applied in all of the other companies, not just the one that I'm on the board, but I would say this is one of the key commandments for a modern organization. Think what you have to do to reinvent yourself continuously without losing your position.
With regard to competitors, I read recently where an article that you talked about Mercedes being a very strong competitor. We also have very strong competitors with many of our products at Microsoft. How does a company benefit from having strong competitors?
The worst situation a company can be in is not having a competitor or not noticing the competitors, because that influences the mentality within the organization. If your team, whether it's a team of 50 or a team of 100,000, thinks we are the only ones out there, gee, aren't we great? You begin to sit back, slouch in your chair, and kind of say, we don't have to worry about anything. We have the best solutions out there. Makes you lazy, complacent, and then you don't really notice where the dramatic or small and later dramatic shifts are happening in there. So a competitor is absolutely healthy and helpful because it keeps you on your toes. It keeps you kind of awake and aware that each day you have to convince the consumer why your product, your service is better than the competitors. If you take it for granted, you don't work as hard. You don't think as a creative person, what do we have to add in the next generation?
Helmut, thank you so much for talking to us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.